Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to talk about energy and the election today on the show, to begin the show at least. With me, Steph Tai, a law professor at UW-Madison. Steph, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Greg Nemeth with us as well, professor in the La Falla School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Greg, great to have you with us.
Hi, Larry. Great to be on.
As we talk with these two experts, love to have you join in. What questions do you have about energy issues? What are you concerned about the role of science when it comes to policy issues? You can join in at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Steph, let's start with you. You've been on the Ideas Network before, but not with our show. So maybe you could talk a bit about your background when it comes to energy issues.
So I teach environmental and administrative law at UW, and I've also worked on a number of sort of climate change-related amicus briefs on behalf of scientists around the country. So in terms of presenting the science behind climate change to courts, I've done a lot of volunteer work on that in the past.
Yeah, I know one of your areas of interest is energy justice issues. Maybe you could expand or explain about that.
Yeah, so energy justice includes a lot of different kind of issues. One of the primary issues that it includes is the consideration of health effects that disproportionately affect coming from power plants that disproportionately affects both low income and minority members of our communities. They're often cited in places which are contain, you know, lower income folks, usually minority folks. And so the health effects coming from the pollutants coming from these plants greatly sort of are targeted in a way towards these folks. And so addressing that kind of justice issue is part of energy justice. But the other part of energy justice is also making sure that everyone has access to energy that is both safe and accessible in terms of pricing, too. So that's the other part of it, sort of obtaining energy in a just kind of way. And those, so those two, I would call the two larger elements of energy justice.
Yeah, that's great. We can certainly talk some more about that, but I want to bring Greg in, too. Greg, one of the things I know we wanted to talk about with you, actually with both of you today, is an upcoming seminar that you are moderating. Greg, tell us about it.
Yeah, I mean, part of what we're trying to do is bring some faculty voices and talk to the public about what's at stake in the election on energy and climate issues. And, you know, one thing we like to do is just make it clear where the candidates stand. I mean, the Republican candidate, Trump, has a four-year track record and mostly wants to continue along those lines. So just make it clear to people what has happened and what the plan is for a second Trump administration. And then, you know, what's the contrast with the Democratic candidate Biden about what his platform calls for? And so one part of it is just to make it clear what the candidates have said they want to do. And they're very different plans. And so that's one thing that they can help. And then also just to bring other perspectives in about what people think should be on the agenda that's not, and then and talk to the public about that as well. So that's our plan for the Wisconsin Energy Institute forum on the election and energy coming up. I think a lot is really at stake. And so these are always important issues, but the candidates are so divergent on some of the key parts of them that, you know, it's a really important part of the choice that comes up in November.
And when is the seminar? Maybe you can give us the specifics on the seminar itself.
So the seminar is at the Wisconsin Energy Institute, and of course, these days it'll be online, and it's at 4:30 on October 20th.
4:30 October 20th. Okay. Well, when it comes to energy, what power does the president have? Steph, maybe you can start with a comment.
Well, one of the things, so there's two major sources of power. One is sort of the actual regulation and requirements for power plants. And this is through the EPA or sometimes through executive orders directing the EPA to develop a particular type of regulation. So that's one area which has major effects on energy policy because it shapes how power plants operate. Another part, too, is that we haven't talked about yet is federal public lands policy. Around 40% of U.S. coal production, 25% of oil production, and 23% of U.S. natural gas production is actually produced on what are called public lands. These are lands owned by the United States, and they're open for mining and drilling, but depending on the administration, more areas can be open or fewer areas can be open. And so that's also a significant portion of U.S. energy policy as well.
Yeah.
Greg, do you have anything else to add?
Sorry, were you just asking for me?
Yeah. Greg. Yeah, go ahead, Greg.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, thanks, Professor Tai. The one thing I'd add is I agree. The two things I'd add, one is that, you know, that the election at the same time we're electing the president, we're also electing new members of Congress or renewing some. So that's also plays a big role. And then second, I think the biggest thing is how a president and his agenda sets expectations, because a lot of things related to energy have to do with the longer term future, whether we're talking about climate change or transitioning our energy system. I mean, some of the local utilities have targets for 2050. The state has a target for 2050. And that's because people make investments in power plants that last for many, many decades. So part of what a president's agenda does is kind of set expectations for where things are likely to go in the next 4 years, but even beyond that. So I think that's a lot of what the difference in the two candidates' positions on energy issues affect. It's these long-term decisions and long-term trajectories.
Yeah. Well, we have callers online with questions and some open lines. You can join in at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Carolyn and Madison up first, so let's go there. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. I'm wondering if a candidate who promotes old Green New Deal stuff and fossil-free energy would be able to promise a view of the Milky Way, even in the heart of a city. And here's why I think that might be possible. It depends on, do coal and nuclear power plants, can their turbines be slowed down at night as demand slows down? I think they don't. I think they keep running all night, right? At full speed?
I can answer that one.
Go ahead, Greg.
Yeah, so, you know, generally our power system uses probably half as much electricity at night as it does during the day. And so we need half as much energy. And it's not going to be sunny at night, so we don't have any solar power. But we do have wind, so that produces some electricity. We have some nuclear, and so that might probably run at night. And in the past, you're right that coal would be running almost all the time and would be contributing to pollution, and that might obscure some of the views of the stars at night, if that's what you're focused on. I agree, that was probably true in the past, and that's been a dramatic difference in the last 10 years, is now we're shutting down coal plants because they're no longer make money to run them. And so coal plants are probably not running at night anymore very much, whereas in the past they used to. So that's been a big change already that hasn't happened because of policy, but it has mainly happened because of markets that, you know, favor renewables and natural gas. So some of that's already happening. And I think going forward with that, we have even less coal and probably less natural gas if we did kind of this Green New Deal approach that you referred to. So I do think there's a potential for better skies at night and that we're already going in that direction.
Mm. Carolyn, thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Jeff in Superior. Jeff, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, good morning. I think the strength of President Trump's leadership in the past 4 years has accomplished energy independence in our country. He's renegotiated trade agreements, which has put money in our U.S. Treasury. And he's appointed three people to the Supreme Court to preserve our social values. When you look at Biden, 47 years, what has he done in public service but made himself very wealthy? His family, and we're going to see in the debates tomorrow the character of two very different people. One puts America first, and one puts himself first.
Hmm. Well, let's get some comments from both. Steph, let's start with you.
I'm not sure I understand the question here, but it depends on what you consider America first. If you're thinking about in terms of environmental protection, in terms of the health effects of pollutants coming from power plants, I would say the Biden plan, in that perspective, does put America first, actual Americans first, versus the hands of many of these companies that are not necessarily even American-owned. So that's one perspective. But again, this depends on what you consider putting America first. It's a very ambiguous phrase in that sense.
Yeah. Greg, comment?
Yeah, and I would just, I think, agree with the caller that they really do have extremely different viewpoints on what they would do with energy. And so that for sure is true. I think it's also fair to say that the U.S. is becoming less energy dependent on imports of energy, less dependent on imports of energy. And a lot of that has happened under the Trump administration. I think it's hard to kind of causally say that it's been Trump administration policies that have led to that. But it's certainly being true that we're importing less energy than we have in the past because we're becoming less reliant on imports of oil from other places. And we've got this domestic resource of natural gas and increasingly renewables. And I think, it seems to me that both candidates would be kind of moving things in that same direction, but via different ways, of course. I think the Trump administration wants to do deregulation and more fossil fuels, and the Biden administration is to do Green New Deal and a less carbon intensive and more renewables. But I think they both go in the direction of importing less energy and being more energy independent.
Thank you very much for that question. And again, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org. Let's turn to Ron in Madison. Ron, your turn. Thank you for calling.
Thanks. Correction. Electric turbine generators must be maintained at exactly the same speed so they produce 60 cycle alternating current all the time, and whenever a power plant is bringing another generator online, they must very carefully adjust it even finer than 1/120th of a second. They must get the peaks and valleys exactly lined up within 1/1000th of a second. Otherwise, they totally mess up the system. They must totally synchronize it. They cannot slow a turbine down. They can reduce the amount of steam they run into it. They can reduce the amount of electricity that comes out of the generator. And they can totally turn off some of the generators, whether they're coal, natural gas, nuclear, hydropower, whatever. They can turn some off and then turn them back on the next morning. But they must not change the speed at all. They must be totally synchronized at exactly 60 hertz. Otherwise, our modern electronic equipment is damaged.
Well, I thank you very much for calling, Ron. A comment from you, Greg.
Yeah, I think what Ron's comment illustrates is just it's unbelievable how amazing this energy electricity system that we have, that, say, two-thirds of the country has to all work within 5 or 10% of what he said of 60 cycles per second of current alternating back and forth, and that everything has to be synchronized. It's amazing. And it's something we've optimized over the last 100 years. And it becomes even more challenging when you think about not having generators that you can control, like coal and gas, but having generators that are affected by nature, like by sun to solar panels and wind for wind turbines. And so that's a big challenge now is how do you get the energy system to work if, say, if we have a third of our electricity or more coming from these generating sources that are clean, but which we don't fully control because they're affected by clouds, thunderstorms, and wind and things like that. But I'm pretty optimistic that we can find a way to work on that. So that part is really a key system engineering challenge. But just to get at the kind of the source of that comment, the other part that's true, though, is that coal plants used to run about 80% of the time, and they're now running about 50% of the time. And they still have to work on that 60 cycles per second frequency, but they're not running as much. And so that's been a huge improvement in terms of air quality, including visual and being able to see the stars because we're running coal power plants less. And that's something that I don't think anyone expected 10 years ago. We've shut down a quarter of the U.S.'s coal power plants in the last 10 years. And that's leading to a lot of benefits in terms of having domestic energy, having cleaner energy, and then preparing the grid for dealing with these more intermittent resources. So, yeah, it's a good point by the caller, but it's important to realize that coal has started to go away in a big way in the U.S.
Talking today with Greg Nemeth, a professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and Steph Tai, a law professor at UW-Madison. She's interested in administrative law and how it impacts energy and the environment, as well as energy justice issues. You can join in at 800-642-1234, email at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Natalie Guyette, our on-air producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at energy issues, energy in the election with our two guests, Greg Nemeth from the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison, and Steph Tai, law professor at UW-Madison with interest in administrative law and how it impacts energy and the environment. Questions for them, give a call at 1-800-642-1234, email at ideas@wpr.org. Gary in Ween, Wisconsin, has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Gary.
Good morning, Larry. Interesting show, as always.
Thank you.
My comment would be that as we enter the middler years of the 21st century, we continue to do things which the people who will follow us on the planet are going to end up paying for. Instead of being more energy efficient and cutting down on all different types of pollution, we just kick the can down the road for short-term profits. And in years to come, these issues are going to have to be dealt with. And when you come to the issue of global warming, the costs are going to be enormous. And it's just irresponsible of us to not do it. And because I'm a little older now, I see that quite clearly, but seems like it's not getting through to a lot of people.
Well, let's get a comment. Steph, do you want to comment?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one thing to observe is that a lot of the climate activism is coming from the younger generations who are focused both on protesting and on leading many lawsuits against governments around the world for failing to address climate change adequately. And so you're seeing that kind of concern coming from these future generations that you've been talking about. And I think this is a very visible issue to them in ways that older generations haven't been paying attention to.
Yeah. Leo in Milwaukee, on to you now. Hi, Leo.
Hi. I am an electrical engineer, and I would like to expand on the comment that was made by a previous caller about 60-cycle synchronization. He is correct in that. However, you're leaving out a very important point, which is power generators are designed to run at constant torque, which means that there is a constant energy input and there is a constant energy output. So if you have a 50-megawatt generator, it is putting out 50 megawatts 24 hours a day, no matter what. That power has to go somewhere. If you've ever wondered why you see the streetlights and the freeway come on in the middle of the day, it's because they're dumping the excess power. So you can't just put in less coal and slow it down. It just doesn't work that way.
Greg, a comment.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that the energy system needs to do is be more flexible in the future. And so when we think about, you know, a harder-to-control system because we have to deal with thunderstorms and wind and things are outside of our direct control, we have to think about ways that we can make this, in a way, kind of fragile grid that we all depend on work well. And, you know, there's a few different ways we can do it. We can have sometimes it's called demand response. So have energy get used different ways. So the streetlights that Leo just mentioned is one way that you could kind of take up excess. But you might also make room if we don't have enough energy at certain times to do certain activities later. So having demand be more flexible matters. Having storage in the system matters. Mm-hmm. So that used to be just impossibly expensive and not even an option at all, is to save energy when it's plentiful, like when it's windy or really sunny, and use it later in the day or later in the week. And that we now have in a lot of places, including in our state, where we have batteries that are set up to store energy at one time and then use it later. And so there's technologies, there's behavioral, and hopefully regulations and policies that kind of enable those different aspects to come onto it to make the grid different than it has been in the past, which has tended to be a bit more rigid and controlled, and to look something more in the future that kind of is like how the internet works, where there's a lot more kind of resilience in the system. There's different ways of buffering different sources of demand and supply that are not as controllable as in the past. So it's a big challenge, and it's changing a system that we've relied on for a long time. But there's a lot of ways we can do it, and there's a lot of examples of other places that have lots of renewables, for example, where it's actually working pretty well, and the lights aren't going out, and things are working pretty well. So, but that's a big challenge we face, is upgrading and modernizing that system. But it's also an opportunity. Think of all the companies that could provide controls and storage and technologies like that, and the jobs that come up for that, and the expertise we're going to need in regulation to think about how we design rules that compensate different entities for providing storage or things like that. So I think, you know, this idea of modernizing the energy system, which is certainly a challenge, is not a bad thing. It's a great opportunity, and it leads to this good goal in the end, which is a system that's kind of more reliable and cleaner.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Leo, for that question. Steph, Greg just mentioned regulations. I'm wondering what role does the EPA and well, maybe other agencies as well, what role do they play when it comes to laws and regulations?
Well, the EPA has most of its authority to address energy generation through the Clean Air Act. And it's been doing so on and off since Massachusetts versus EPA, where the Supreme Court said that carbon dioxide can count as a pollutant under the Clean Air Act. And so on and off, the Obama administration had put in some regulations regarding how coal-fired power plants have to operate. And then the Trump administration has rescinded a number of those. So that's one area. Another is about methane kind of emissions. So that's another part, which provide the hook for the EPA to regulate power plants and power plants and drilling in oil refineries in some kind of way. And so these are the aspects that the EPA can have to do that. I want to pivot, though, a little bit to also recognize the role of state energy planning agencies, too, because they often are on the ground planning the sort of state energy portfolio. And so it's not just the federal government that matters. And in terms of, I would say, election kind of thing, since we're focused on the election, state elections matter as well in terms of having folks in there to move towards either, you know, staying fossil fuel energy portfolio or moving more towards renewables. As Greg has mentioned, there are many other reasons to move towards renewables, and many folks in private industry are already doing so regardless of regulations, but state energy policies also matter in this area.
Yeah. What about the courts, the role of courts in energy and environmental law?
Yeah, courts play a large role as well, and that's where it gets trickier. So on the federal level, federal courts will address any kind of environmental policy coming from the next administration, be it Trump or Biden. They're going to review any kind of future. Right now in court already is the Trump administration's repeal of the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan. It's called the Affordable Clean Energy Act. Right now it's already before courts. We'll see whether or not what courts will say about whether or not that rescission was done under the authority of under the rules of the Administrative Procedure Act. The Administrative Procedure Act, in turn, is a statute that governs how agencies make any kind of regulatory decisions. And it produces a number of requirements, such as they need to have an adequate record of information, they need to cross a lot of T's and dot I's, and courts play a large role in determining whether or not agencies have fulfilled all those requirements that the Administrative Procedure Act. And so in turn, that's one way where courts have a large amount of oversight over what agencies can do. But the other thing, too, besides the Administrative Procedure Act, is also just whether or not there's statutory authority. So another claim that can come out, for instance, from groups challenging a Biden administration's new EPA rule might be that the Clean Air Act doesn't actually give the EPA authority to do whatever it is it's trying to do. And so that's another area where this will get tested in court.
Let's take some more calls. Janet in Exonia, it's your turn. Hi, Janet.
Good morning. Out in Exonia, we're dealing with a proposed We Energy's liquefied natural gas terminal. They have put under contract 160 acres to put in a 15-story tank that will hold about 12 million gallons of liquefied natural gas. This will be occurring on land that is zoned agricultural, and they have applied for a zoning variance. 90% of the people in Exonia don't want it. The people who do want it are, of course, the farmer who's selling the land and the farmer's attorney, who both spoke at our last meeting. But in spite of that, our town board decided to vote for it because we will get $550,000 a year from the state for allowing this in Exonia. Our problem is that it is 6/10 of a mile from our grade school and our fire department. So if it let loose, the fire department would be destroyed, and from the research we've done, no little local fire department could deal with a spill anyway. If there's a leak, this stuff does not need an ignition source to explode. It can explode if it goes down in your well or in a sewer or between your barn and your house, because anywhere it gets contained, it can explode.
Janet, what's your question to our guests then?
My question is, what is the, as far as energy justice goes, what should be the sway of the local population in dealing with these installations? No one surrounding this even has natural gas. They all have propane because there's no lines out there.
Okay.
So they're asking us to have our community, our nice rural agrarian community, disrupted and the property values go down so that they can ship this natural gas to Waukesha and Milwaukee County.
All right, I want to break in here. Janet, thank you for that comment and question. Maybe turn to Greg first. Greg, a comment.
Yeah, I guess just two things. I also like to hear Steph's take on it. I guess first is, yeah, it does raise, this is exactly what energy justice comes down to. It's like, where do we locate things, who benefits, and who, pays the cost or really suffers the risk of something being not safe? And that's really an energy justice issue. And, I assume we'll be hearing more things like that as that gets more attention. And then second, I just think if we're thinking about, these long-term targets of trying to decarbonize our electricity supply and eventually decarbonize all our energy, investment now in fossil fuel infrastructure, whether it's for oil or natural gas or coal, boy, that just seems like a pretty risky way to use your money, because at some point, just like coal plants are facing now, a lot of oil producing facilities are facing now, and natural gas places are losing money as well. At some point, those investments look really risky and don't kind of fit with where the general public wants to go and with where markets want to go. And I think, people considering potentially risky expensive fossil fuel infrastructure should look at what's happened to coal companies and fracking companies in the last 10 years and think, is that where we really want to kind of build our future on. So, yeah, but I'd also like to hear Steph's take on it.
Yeah, Steph, you want to chime in?
Yeah, no, I agree with everything that Greg said. And I'm talking more now on just sort of what folks on the local level can do. It sounds like the zoning board already or the county already made some kind of decision. But one thing to do is to sort of keep up with the public comments on any kind of permitting kind of thing that the power plant will have to access. Most power plants or even power storage facilities will have to obtain a number of permits, either locally or from the DNR. And I know this is often very inaccessible to general members of the public, but sort of trying to pay attention to that process of when they're applying for permits and what kinds of permits they're obtaining is important, because what happens is during the permit getting process, they're going to need to get some kind of approval. And there's often an opportunity for the public to comment. And then you can bring up all of these risks that you're facing. And so that's something that is one of the reasons why there's often not climate justice, is because those who are least well off and also have the least resources are the ones that are least likely to also raise these objections during the permitting process. But the more you can keep on it and the more you can sort of coordinate together to pay attention to that, I think the stronger off your community will be.
Jenna, thank you again for calling. Appreciate your call. Helen in Cameron, your turn now. Hi, Helen.
Hi, I had three questions, and I was wondering which one of them I could, I'll cite the three, and you can answer whichever of the three. The first thing is, I live on a farm in Cameron, and I have this very high windmill. Is it feasible to connect a wind charger on top of it? Number two, is the electric company obligated to connect and buy the excess energy that I would produce? And number three, does Wisconsin have a penalty for implementing wind or solar energy like it does for my Prius? I had to pay $60 extra on my license because I have a hybrid car.
All right. Greg, do you want to take a crack?
Yeah. I think I missed the first one, so I'll move on to the second and the third about. Does the electric company have to buy electricity from you? Basically, yeah. That's a law called the Public Utility Regulatory Policy Act from 1978 that said small-scale generators have access to the electric grid. But then, you know, in the 40 years since then, it's kind of the devil's in the details in terms of how states implement that federal law. But, you know, in general, yes, the idea is that the grid should be accessible to everybody, that the utility doesn't have a monopoly on generation. They have a monopoly on distribution, on who the customers are. So one is, yeah, you can sell that, although the devil's in the implementation details. And then in terms of penalties.
Yeah, formula that the state uses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so some companies can offer a higher percentage or a lower percentage of, you know, what they'll pay than others within the state. I know that for sure.
Yeah. Well, I think what this comes down to, so in general, yes, that's the federal regulation. And in reality, in implementation detail, it really all comes down to three people that are about 2 miles west of the Wisconsin Capitol, and really it's just two people, who are the commissioners at the Wisconsin Public Service Commission. And they're the people that actually decide on how electricity gets paid for and who pays and who gets compensated. And it's three people that are appointed by governors, and really two of them have to be on the same side. So it's amazing how much of our state's energy future, including Helen's question, come down to the decisions of two political appointees. But that's just a crucial organization. If you think about the 100 or so people that work there, play a huge role in our state's energy future. And so I'm just in favor of having more people there, thinking about the consequences of these issues, thinking about the justice issues, thinking about the technological solutions. But I think not enough people know how much of these answers to some of these questions like Helen's here come down to a small number of people that get very little public attention, but their decisions are open for public comment and their hearings. And I just encourage more people to get involved with that as some of these energy issues become closer to home.
Yeah. Thanks again, Helen, for that question. And maybe we have time for David LaCrosse to join in. David, hi.
Hi. Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, we have more than a century of evidence that carbon dioxide contributes to global warming. And that's mightily responsible for a lot of the fires in California and the floods in the Gulf Coast and the East Coast. And we're burning 37 million, or putting like 37 billion tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere every year. So that does not help the United States. And Wisconsin has no fossil fuels. So if we were to make renewables and battery storage devices here, I think that would be a lot better. And I'd just like your comments on the possibility of that.
Okay. Steph, do you want to start?
Well, just to start off with, Wisconsin actually uses a relatively high amount of renewables. It's not like, you know, top renewable energy state like, for instance, Washington or Oregon, but it makes up 50% of our energy is generated by renewables. Now, most of that is biomass. Which is a little bit more controversial among environmentalists about whether or not, you know, what the actual environmental benefits of it are. But we also have an okay amount, I guess 7% is of our energy generation is from wind and solar. So the possibility of us moving to a greater degree of renewable portfolio, I think, is something that Tony Evers has promised. And so we'll see what happens with that. Again, as Greg mentioned, that'll depend upon the makeup of our Public Service Commission and also a number of other sort of state legislative kind of decisions as well.
And Dave, thank you again. Marvin, I want to ask you to hold on from Monroe for our next guests that who are going to be talking more about climate change. But Greg, could you remind us again about the event that's coming up in October, the seminar?
Right. Yeah. So the Wisconsin Energy Institute, which is based at the UW-Madison, had this idea to do an event just a little couple weeks before the election to think of some of these issues, whether it's climate change, energy justice, and to scope out the issues, identify what the candidates' positions are, and, you know, have a dialogue like we've had this morning with the callers about what people think and what people's questions are, just to, you know, to raise the salience of this topic. And so that's October 20th, 4:30 from the Wisconsin Energy Institute, and that'll be an online event.
Well, I want to thank both of you for taking time to be with us today. Obviously, a lot of interest in this and appreciate your comments. Steph Tighe, thank you so much. And Greg Nemeth, thank you as well. Very much appreciate it.
Great. Thanks
very much.
Thanks to the callers. Great questions.
Yeah. Greg Nemeth is the professor in the La Falla School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. He's the author of a soon-to-be-released book, How Solar Became Cheap. Maybe we can have him back to talk about his book. Steph Tighe, a law professor at UW-Madison, with an interest in administrative law and how it impacts energy and the environment, as well as energy justice issues. Great to have both of them with us. Climate change came up a bit during the conversation with them, and we are going to kind of continue that with our weather guys next on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.